And she was in education for 27 years, and she's also got 9 years of school administration expertise. And currently she's traveling the world and teaching people about not just a physical education, but also a spiritual education, something that can make your life better on a deeper level, something like we've been trying to do at the talks here. So tonight we will hear from her how to further cultivate a sense of goodness in our lives. And she's a teacher, so she's a good speaker, and we will definitely have that. Thank you very much.
This is a rocking chair, but it's a little different style of rocking chair. So it's October 20th, 2016, in Stellenbosch, South Africa. And I'm going to be looking at about coming to the mode of goodness. So in the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the primary texts on yoga and meditation and spirituality, it's quite fascinated me how in the beginning of the 14th chapter, Krishna says, "Now I'm going to tell you something better than anything I told you before." And he starts to talk about the modes of material nature. So understanding about these modes, and particularly the mode of goodness, brings us to freedom, clarity, and purity in our lives. So why should we study about these, what's called the modes of nature? Because they affect everything that we do. Our perception. So I'm sure many of you know that it's not that what we observe with our senses forms our beliefs, but rather our beliefs change what we perceive. You all know that? Yes? So the modes that we're in change our inner beliefs and our perceptual filter. They also affect what kind of choices we make, how intelligent we are in making our choices, whether our choices turn out right, what kind of health that we have, what kind and amount of happiness we have, what we know, and what results we get from our actions. Now, as you're probably aware, science has been looking for a unified field theory for a very long time, something you could put on a t-shirt, right? A simple equation. One difficulty with the hard sciences is they're assuming that, first of all, what they know is complete, although they know that what they know is very incomplete. And also they're assuming that what they know applies throughout the universe, although they also know that what they know probably doesn't apply throughout the universe. So is there a principle of material law? Is there some way that light could be put like down or something? Yeah. So is there some principle of material law that is actually complete and universal? So at least according to the Bhagavad Gita, that is this law of the three modes of nature. So we're going to be looking at each of these modes and also that which is above the modes. The modes is something material, and we're going to look at bhakti, which is transcendent to the modes. We're going to be looking at four things. Bhakti, the mode of goodness, the mode of passion, and the mode of ignorance. So let's look at first a general definition. What do we mean by bhakti? Bhakti involves yoga, or linking of the self with the supreme, linking of the self with all other selves and even with matter. A feeling of connectedness and an acting in connectedness. What we call akarma, or a liberating action, action that does not bind you to the laws of nature. Our senses filled with attraction to the Lord and all varieties of ecstasies of love. Altogether, there are 12 main ecstasies or rasas of love that combine in different ways. So this is the transcendent position. Then in what's called sattva, or goodness, sat literally means existence, what is true. So here is karma yoga. Karma yoga is action that is meant for liberation. Also akarma, action that does not produce reaction. Senses illuminated instead of by love, the senses illuminated by knowledge, and a general feeling of happiness and knowledge. You could think of sattva or goodness as being equilibrium, balance, peace, forgiveness, harmony, mercy, compassion. A sense of goodness is you're doing the right thing just because it feels so right to do the right thing. Then the mode of passion is also called rajas. Rajas is a Sanskrit word that means both passion and king. Now, if you were to think about the medieval kings, that wouldn't really give us the right idea. But if you think about like an ideal fairy tale king, that might give you a little bit more of an idea, some very noble character who really cares. You know, the ideal politician that we never seem to get, right? I am so embarrassed right now to be an American with the current politics going on. It's really, really embarrassing. But the idea of a political leader who's really noble and who cares about the people and who's full of justice and fairness and ethics. So here we're now in karma. Karma meaning pious action. Material action that brings you a good result. But there are unlimited desires and longings in this mode of passion. Again, if you think of a righteous king who wants to expand their kingdom, kind of the bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, bigger, better, more, more, bigger, better, more, and more. That's very much the mode of passion. And also actions done for personal gain. Now, maybe it might be personal fame. Maybe you want to help others so your statue will be in the park. History books. It may not necessarily be for cash. Great attachment for the results. It's very future oriented. Mode of goodness is very present oriented. Bhakti and goodness are present oriented. And passion is very future oriented, which is why we have this little carrot here. Why we have the carrot? It's very much about what is the result? What result will I get in the future? And intense endeavor to get that result. It's basically work, 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 result. Work, 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 work. Well, of course, there's not always a result. So therefore, it's mixed happiness and suffering because sometimes you work, 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 and there's no result. The mode of passion is the general mode of the human beings. So it gives a little idea. Whereas goodness gives a great idea. Bhakti is complete understanding. Goodness is almost complete understanding. And passion gives you some. Philosophy, art, culture, moral, ethics, this is all part of the mode of passion. You can think of this as what we would call, you know, really civilized life. Think of it as a grand, beautiful city full of art, music, parks. Everyone is treated ethically and fairly. You think of goodness as like being out in a forest that's filled with fruit and flowers and birds. Then we have the mode of ignorance. And the mode of ignorance is vikarma. This is sinful action. This is action that gets you bad karma. And just madness, laziness, sleep, inertia, illusion, and just suffering. So the mode of ignorance is predominantly seen among the animals and the criminals. But we also have it somewhat in human society. So why are we interested in goodness at all? Because today we're going to be focusing on goodness. Why aren't we only interested in bhakti? Now, there's an interesting statement in the Bhagavat Purana where Krishna says, until you're fully spiritually realized, it's a good idea to work in goodness. And here we also have from another section of the Bhagavat Purana that one can achieve transcendence and enlightenment, but one has to be able to receive it. In one sense, transcendence and enlightenment and love of God is around us at every moment. It's actually who we are. It's not really something that we need to become. It's not really something we need to work for. It's really something we just have to accept. Does that make sense to everybody? You can talk to it as just a letting go of illusion or just an acceptance of who we really are. But in order to do that, we're most favorably situated in the mode of goodness. So here, Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master, said, according to our attitude, Krishna becomes one's direct advisor. One sees Krishna everywhere and in everything, or Krishna's unknown. And it's not Krishna's partiality, it's his response to our ability to understand him. He's equal to everyone, and according to our ability to receive his favor, we advance in consciousness of him. The more we advance in sattva-guna, or the mode of goodness, the more our brilliance is exhibited, and the more we're covered by rajaguna, or passion, or tamaguna, or ignorance, the less visible this brilliance. Now, one way you could think of this is just like with a window. So you have that shade there that's pretty much opaque, right? There's hardly any light that's getting in that back shade at all. So that would be like ignorance or tamaguna. You're basically in, you can't see. And then the other one is a little bit more open. So if we were to open it even a little bit more, if we were open the louvers a little bit more, that would be like the mode of passion. You're getting some light and you're getting the shapes of what's outside, but it's not very clear. If we were to pick the shade all the way up, that would be like the mode of goodness. And if you were to go outside, that would be like in bhakti. Okay. So what happens according to the modes of nature and bhakti as far as where we go at the end of this life? Now, something interesting about the Bhagavad Gita is it's not just a dichotomy. It's not just, well, if you believe in this religion, you go to heaven, and if you don't believe in this religion, you go to hell. And you've got a one-life shot at it. I don't understand, frankly, really, why somebody would be attracted to a philosophy of a God like that. If you believe in me, I give you an eternal reward, and if you don't believe in me, I give you an eternal punishment. I've never been able to comprehend why that's even attractive. I can see why people would be afraid and would act out of fear, but it's hard for me to comprehend love if you think God is like that. So in the Bhagavad Gita, we understand that we have many, many, many lifetimes. We're eternal beings, and there's no material state that's eternal, either a heavenly or a hellish one. But where we go at the end of this life is very, very individual. So let's say we cultivate bhakti. Let's say we cultivate transcendence. If we completely are in transcendence, we don't reincarnate at all. We regain our spiritual form, and we go to the kingdom of God. If we somewhat cultivate bhakti, then either we take birth in a family of yogis on this earth, or we take birth on the higher planets. And there's all varieties of higher planets. If one dies in the mode of goodness, one can take birth on the higher planets, or as a philosopher, or poet, or scientist on this earth. If we die in the mode of passion, if we're very much in the mode of passion, we'll get a human body, but with great wealth and prestige and power on this earth. And if we die in the mode of ignorance, we can go to lower planets or animals, or if partially in the mode of ignorance, we'll take birth on this planet, but in a very unfortunate situation. Now, of course, there's all varieties in between. Does that make sense? Just like that shade there, as I said, if we opened it a little bit more, it would really be in the mode of passion. You can see you could have all varieties, right? It's a continuum. We're going to talk about bhakti, goodness, passion, ignorance, as if they were just isolated blocks. But it's a continuum and there's a mix. So we might have some aspects of our life in bhakti and some in passion and some in goodness. And so therefore most of us get a life that's kind of mixed and not fully one thing or another. Does that make sense to everybody? So we're going to look now at persons in each of these modes. So what's a person like if they're in bhakti? So they're going to have a connection with Krishna and with great friendship and affection. They're going to have complete knowledge. Complete knowledge means they understand how everything works, how everything fits together, how everything is ultimately perfect. They're never agitated by material happiness and distress because they have a higher standard of happiness. They're unconquerable by meditating on Krishna's opulent incarnations. They are detached even from wanting liberation because they have something higher than just freedom. And therefore, they're not interested in external duties of ordinary religions. They're not so interested in the rituals and formulas of already religions or sectarianism. They're really beyond those sort of rules and regulations of religion. Of course, a lot of people try to imitate this. A lot of people think, well, let me use the result as the means. So I'm sure Kamasita would particularly know about this as she studied a lot of literacy. But when you're teaching children how to read, you have to teach them the sounds of the letters. Now, when you're a good reader, you don't read like that. You don't read never. You don't sound out your letters like that. In fact, good readers read whole phrases at a time. We read a phrase, and while we're reading that phrase, we're predicting the next phrase. So someone had the brilliant idea that we could teach five-year-old children how to read by having them read the same way that fluent readers read. Well, it was an utter failure. You know, only a couple of percentage points of kids really learned how to read like that. So many people think that because in an ultimate state of enlightenment, one is not interested in religions and rules and morality, that therefore I can give up all of that when I'm a beginner, and that's going to bring me to enlightenment. What about persons in goodness? They're satisfied in themselves. The Sanskrit is called Atma Rama, or Apta Kama, or Atma Rati, or Atma Tushta. You know, it's the word Atma. Atma means self. Atma Rama means that they really like their selves. Atma Tushta, they're satisfied with themselves. That doesn't mean our material self. Being satisfied with your material self, my dear friends, is pretty hard. Yes? Anybody look at the mirror this morning and went, perfect! Right? Or with our mind and our personality. But this is talking about the spiritual self, that one can be fully satisfied. Because the spiritual self, our real self, is just wonderful. So they take their pleasure from within. They see everything equally. And they're always endeavoring for spiritual perfection. Now, these people are devoted to ritual performances and even austerities, not violent or very lusty after sensual pleasure. Their interest is mostly in religiosity, economic development, and regulated sense gratification. And they follow the rules of the Vedas or religious scriptures. They take pleasure in knowledge and austerity. In passion, they want glory. So a person in goodness, they're getting their happiness from within. A person in bhakti, they're getting their happiness in love of God. A person in goodness, they're getting their happiness from within. A person in passion, it's very external. They're getting their happiness from fame and glory, and they're studying the Vedas and the books of knowledge. They have great opulence. They support large families or large groups of people. They really enjoy life with vigor. So they're devoted to their duties, but with ulterior motives. This is, if we're going to have the picture in modern society of the successful person, the kind of people they use to advertise luxury cars and jewelry and watches, you know, those pictures in the magazines, that's this. You know, the beautiful house, and the beautiful spouse, and the beautiful car, and the dog. Then mixed passion, ignorance. Then we're starting to see greed, dissatisfaction, false pride, hypocrisy, and envy start to become manifest because ignorance comes in. And in ignorance itself, you just got greedy, ill behavior, mercilessness, fighting one another without good reason. People who are fighting not for the reason, just to fight. Right? Have you ever seen that? When people fight just to fight? What are you fighting about? I don't know. Does that sometimes go on for generations? You know, my great-great-grandfather had a fight with your great-great-grandfather, and so now we're all going to kill each other? Over what? I don't know. Because you have a slightly different religion. You're a Sunni, and I'm a Shiite, and I'm a Protestant, or I'm a Catholic, or... you know, your skin has got a little bit less melanin than mine or something, you know, your nose is a little different and so we're going to kill each other, and this is very much more to ignorance. Obsessed with material desires, cheating, lying, sloth, sleeplessness, violence, depression, lamentation, bewilderment, fear, and poverty. So we're going to look now that Krishna describes, this is a general view of the modes. We've gotten this mostly from the Bhagavad Gita 14th chapter and also from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 11th canto. Now we're going to look at the Bhagavad Gita, especially the 17th and 18th chapter, where Krishna describes all different aspects of life and what modes they're in. And this information is there so we can choose the aspect from the mode that we would like to be in. So food above the modes is vegetarian, no meat, no fish, no eggs, and it's offered to Krishna with love and devotion. Then we have foods in the mode of goodness. So these foods give us health. They purify our existence. They give us strength and vitality and satisfaction. They're juicy. They're pleasing to the heart. And we have here a commentary by one of our saints in our Gaudiya Vaishnava line, that he says that it's bought with money that was earned purely, cooked purely, served in a pure place by pure people. Virtue, which brings steadiness of mind, enabling one to remain undisturbed in the face of sorrow, pleasing to the stomach and the eye, having some oil, wine, not excessively fatty. So I know when I've eaten foods in the mode of goodness, then I feel energized afterwards. I had a wonderful experience once in India, in Bengal, where I was served a meal made from all locally grown, locally organically grown food that was in there, that was indigenous to the area, prepared with Ayurvedic centuries-old recipes. And it was served Ayurvedically too. I've never been served a meal like this before. They served me one thing at a time, and they would serve that till I was finished, and then I would go on to something else. They didn't have a whole bunch of things on my plate at one time. And the order in which they served it was all according to Ayurvedic principles. And when I finished that meal, I was just felt as if I was full of light and energy, and I could just kind of float out of the room. It was quite an experience. Food in the mode of passion is being very much too much. You remember, passion is more, 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 bigger, better, bigger, better, bigger, better, bigger, better. Goodness is about balance. So bhakti is about love, goodness about balance, passion about more. So too much salt, too much sugar. Too hot, too pungent, too dry. It causes distress, misery, and disease. So it's basically just too much. Too much of anything. So this is distress while you're eating, misery after you're eating, and then long-term disease. So that's food in the mode of passion. Then food in the mode of ignorance is anything that's really old, anything that has no taste. If it's decomposed and putrid, somebody else's leftover food, nasty things. So this affects us in this life and also gives us bad karma in the next life. Okay, austerity. So all of us have to do some austerity. So most of you are students, and if you're students, you have to do some austerity, yes? Your teacher doesn't just hand out your grades for nothing. You have to do some hard work. And this is true for anything. If you want to get anything in life, you have to do austerity. So looking in the different modes. So bhakti is austerity that's normally in goodness, but done for the pleasure of Krishna. And goodness, we're going to go over this in depth, in the body, in the words, and in the mind, and we'll go over this in depth. In passion, it may look like the same austerity of goodness, but it's done out of pride. I am a hardworking person. I sacrifice a lot. I do a lot of really difficult things. Just see how great I am with all the difficult things that I do. And the results of that austerity are not stable or permanent. Austerities and ignorance are with self-torture or a desire to injure oneself or others. You know, to go to a lot of trouble to buy drugs or something like that. Or to go to a lot of trouble to commit a crime. Or just foolish difficulty. You know, staying up all night partying and so you can't function the next day. Okay, let's look at the mode of goodness. Austerity of the body is worship of God. Brahmanas means spiritually enlightened persons. Worship of our gurus, worship of parents, cleanliness, simplicity, nonviolence, and celibacy. Celibacy doesn't mean absolute celibacy, but it means using sex in a proper relationship, in a proper way. Proper relationship in a proper way. This is very revolutionary, but just in case you didn't know that sex is usually connected with reproduction. So if sex is connected with reproduction, then that is considered celibacy. It doesn't have to be complete abstinence from sex. Austerity of speech. If this is all you get from this presentation, this is a really life-transforming one on austerity of speech in the mode of goodness. So there's five aspects of speaking in the mode of goodness. One is that what we say should be true. The next is that the word should be pleasing. It's really the content should be pleasing. The message itself should be pleasing. What we say should benefit others. The words we use should not agitate others. In other words, in modern life, people often enjoy using agitating words, like curse words or very harsh language, in order to kind of shock you. Huh? and regularly reciting the Vedic literature, speaking from the sacred writings of the world. So these are the five austerities of speech. Anybody want to guess which of these five is most important? Yes.
The first one, truthful.
That's a very good guess.
Because it's first.
But no, sorry. Excuse me?
The last one.
Regularly reciting the Vedas, also an excellent guess, but sorry. Yes, see, what's beneficial? The most important is that whatever we say should benefit us and whoever hears us. Sometimes truth is not beneficial, isn't it? Right? Oh boy, you have a really ugly baby. I mean, that might be. I had a situation recently. Really, I really did. I'm not joking. Where somebody made me avocado ice cream. Really, right? I'm not making this up. Now, fortunately, the person who made it wasn't there when I was served it. They made it and gave it to someone else to give to me, which was a very good thing, that they weren't there. And I thought, well, I'll at least taste it. Right, so I tasted it. I went, oh, it's boy as bad as I thought it would be. And a couple days later, I met the person who'd made it, and she said, oh, I'm the one who made the avocado ice cream. Did you like it? I never answered her question. I just said, oh, you know, I've never heard of avocado ice cream before. It was definitely something different. So sometimes what's truthful is not beneficial. You understand? Also beneficial can refer to time. Maybe what's beneficial for somebody a week from now is not beneficial for them right now. Someone's not ready to hear something yet. When we tell people things they're not ready to hear, what's motivating us? Truthful things that they're not ready to hear, that they can't accept. What's our motivation for doing that?
Passion.
Passion, definitely. Our own pride. If I tell you something that you're not ready to hear and you won't accept, even though it's true, then we can say, just see how superior I am to that person. I tell them the truth and they won't do it. So the main thing is beneficial. And the other things can be sacrificed for beneficial. You can't even use harsh language and say harsh truths if that's going to actually genuinely help somebody. But usually, one should do all five. But the key thing is beneficial. What's going to be most helpful to me and to others? Obviously, generally, the most beneficial thing are things that are truthful, with pleasing content, and not agitating words, and are based on sacred literature. So here's a little bit, kind of putting that together. So if we're speaking or writing, we should ask, is this true? Can the truth be supported in the scriptures? Or even, is it true, you know, here you are in university. I often hear people pull statistics out of the air that they just make up. Do you hear people talk like this in life? I mean, one of my friends wrote this on Facebook the other day. 97% of the people who got married in the 70s in my town got divorced. And I thought, how do you know that? How do you know everyone who got married in your town in the 70s? You know, is there really research on that? And I asked, well, where's the research? And she said, I don't need to do research. I just know it. Well, okay. So is what we're saying true? Is it true in an ordinary sense, and is it true in a cosmic sense? Has this person, by their words, social position, or actions, expressed a sincere willingness to accept the truth I will speak? Just like you've all come in and you've sat down and you're listening to me. So I have some idea that you're willing to accept what I have to say, right? You could always get out your phone and pretend you have an important appointment and leave if you want. So I feel that I have some ability to speak truth to you, that you're open to it. But I wouldn't necessarily walk up to you in the hallway and say, hey, you know, I think I really need to tell you about this. Even though I'm the same person and you're the same person. Because we'd be in a different place at a different time. You all follow? So whether or not I can speak truth to somebody else, first of all, I've got to make sure it is true. And whether or not I can speak truth to someone else depends on whether or not that person has demonstrated that they're open to receiving truth from me. Then next, will this truth and the manner in which I'm presenting it actually benefit me and the hearer? Am I presenting it in the most beneficial way possible? Now, any of you who are teachers, this is true for anything you're teaching. It's not our business just, well, I'm going to teach, and whether you learn it or not, whether you get it or not, is not my problem. That's your problem. But we should always, we should present things in a way that are, as far as we can tell, that are going to be most likely to genuinely help the people that are listening to us. Now, this, of course, obviously, would eliminate a lot of the rubbish that's printed and spoken in the world that has no benefit to anybody. Right? Even though a lot of it may be true. Do you follow? You know, what's happened to such and such movie star with their 10th boyfriend is not of any benefit to anybody, even though it may be true. So, is it true? Is the person receptive to that truth? And am I presenting it in a way that they're most likely to get benefit? Is my presentation in pleasing language so it is more likely to be accepted? And here's a very nice quote, again from the Bhagavad Purana. Sharp arrows which pierce one's chest and reach the heart do not cause as much suffering as the arrows of harsh, insulting words that become lodged within the heart when spoken by uncivilized men. So improper speech, harsh language, harsh truths that are not beneficial to anyone, or lies, deception, cause more damage to a person than physical assault. Austerity of the mind, to be satisfied, to be simple. Simple doesn't mean foolish, but to not unnecessarily complicate one's mind. Gravity again doesn't mean that there's no lightness, and because the mode of goodness is very much that of joy and lightness, but that one is concerned with the things in life that really matter. Self-control, to be able to control the mind and to purify one's existence. So always in consciousness of the divine and to be dedicated to the welfare of others. So if one does that, if one is always conscious of the divine and dedicated to the wealth, to the welfare of others, then these things naturally follow in the mind. So each of these are progressively more difficult. To do a mode of goodness, austerity of the body is hard for most of us at the present time. Speech is harder and the mind is a little harder. So nista means when one's fixed in truth. Brahma-bhuta also means when one's fixed in truth. That's when all of these, the body and speech and our mind, are all fully controlled and used only in divine service. Now at that stage, there's still some willpower exerted, but eventually in bhakti, that sense of using the mind and speech and action in goodness is spontaneous and natural. Okay, we're going to look at charity. So charity is done generally in goodness, but with a connection with Krishna, with a connection with the divine. In goodness, it's given out of duty. By the way, charity here doesn't just mean money. It also may mean things. If you give away your clothes, you give away your car. It may also mean your time. It may also mean your expertise, your knowledge. Any kind of wealth in a very general sense that we give to others. Now, this given out of duty in the mode of goodness should not be understood to be a kind of obligation. But duty is simply because it's the right thing to do. I'm giving to others, I'm helping others, because it is right, it is good, it is in balance, it's the way things should be. And without expecting anything back, just doing it to do it because it's the right thing to do. And because it gives us a feeling of happiness inside. In bhakti, one is giving because it makes the divine happy, which makes me happy out of connection with the divine. In goodness, it's not so much that connection with the divine, it's more I give because then I feel in balance and I feel good about myself and I feel in harmony with myself. and then at the proper time and place to a worthy person. You'll find that the modes have a lot to do with proper time and place. You know, so even if it's a person worthy of giving to, if you give to them at the wrong time and place, it's a disturbance. Does that make sense to you? Then in the mode of passion, you're giving because you want something back. You know, maybe you're giving because you want your name on the building. Or you want everyone to mention, this person gave a lot of money, right? And they have a big dinner in your honor. I remember my mother in her last days, she was in a nursing home, and she'd already given away practically all of her possessions. I mean, all she had was a rocking chair, a painting, and a big plaque honoring her for her charity. You know, that was all that she kept in her last days of life. So, you know, I'm a very charitable, she was a very charitable person. I'm a very, very charitable person. Most of the charity in the world, the big charity, the big foundations. You remember passion is big. I'm helping lots of people. That's very much in the mode of passion. Now, another thing about charity in the mode of passion is it may be grudging. Ah, I'm supposed to give. Everybody in the office is supposed to give. I'm supposed to. Yes, I can. And with regret later, why did I give so much? You know, I could have gotten new tires for my car and a new stereo system. Should I give into them? And out of a feeling of obligation, which is different than duty. Obligation is, you know, your boss asked you, your parents asked you, your, you know, minister asked you, and so you think, all right, I guess I got to do it. By the way, generally in the world, when people ask for money for charity, they actually play into this mode of passion stuff. We'll give you honor, you'll help lots of people, you'll be a great person anyway, you really should do it. Then ignorance, it's to the wrong person. You know, you give a drug addict money to buy drugs, or it's an impure place, improper time, or it's without any attention and respect. Here's something for you, go ahead. The whole external mood is wrong. So mode of goodness charity is you're really giving from joy in your heart. You're giving because you see that this is the way the world should be, that whatever we get, we should share. That it's just the nature of love to want to share. It comes from an overflowing heart. Then understanding in the modes. So in bhakti, we know how to connect with Krishna. We know how to please Krishna. We understand about yoga. We understand what is pleasing to the divine and what is not. Now, goodness, I think of all the reasons, all the material reasons to cultivate the mode of goodness, aside from the spiritual reasons, this is probably the strongest one. You know what to do and what not to do. You know, we have decisions all the time in life. What should I study? You know, should I go to school altogether? What should I study in school? Should I go on to a higher level of education? Should I get married? Who should I marry? Should I have kids? How many kids? Where should I live? What job should I do? What car should I get? And we never know whether those decisions are going to bring us the results that we seek, isn't it? I had a friend just contact me a few days ago. I'm starting a new business. So she doesn't know whether the business will give her money or not. And she doesn't know whether after getting the money she'll be happy or not. Do you follow? Right? So when we make decisions in life, we don't know, will this decision give me the result that I want? And when I get that result, will I like it? In the mode of goodness, you can see these things. In the mode of goodness, you can understand the results of your actions. You know what to do and what not to do. You know what's scary and what's not scary, what's going to bind you to this world and what's going to give you freedom. Again, it's like a clear window. You can, in bhakti, you're out in the sunshine and everything is automatically known to you. In the mode of goodness, at least you have a clear window and you can really see what to do and what not to do. People all the time as I travel the world ask me for advice on this or that particular thing. And many times what I say to them is, what you've got to do is change your consciousness. And when you change your consciousness, you will see yourself what needs to be done. Now, in passion, you can't tell what's religion, what's irreligion, what's good or bad, what's this religion, irreligion, or the words dharma and adharma. What's actually good, what's actually bad, what should be done, what can't be done. So sometimes you get it right, and sometimes you get it wrong. And again, most people are primarily in the mode of passion. Some of the things they do work out, some don't. In ignorance, you're just completely backwards. You think what's good is bad, and what's bad is good. Everything is reversed. And so the results of your decisions are particularly disappointing. And what kind of knowledge do you have? In bhakti, you know that God is personal and loving, and everything is full of his energies. Now, this isn't talking about theoretical knowledge. We're not talking about here theoretical knowledge. We're not talking about a dogma. We're not talking about a set of beliefs. I believe this to be true. We're talking about what you actually know, what you experience as what you know, your lived experience. So one in bhakti understands that there's a personal God whose energies are everywhere in perfection. In goodness, we see that although we have different bodies, we all have the same spiritual nature. We're all equal spiritual souls. In passion, you see, oh, this is a man, this is a woman, this person is black, this person is white, this person is South African, this person is Indian. You see like that. This is a dog. This is a human. This, you know, you understand? Whereas in goodness, you see, this is a soul who right now has the body of a dog. This is a soul who right now has the body of a female Peruvian. In bhakti, you see, oh, Krishna is everywhere and everyone is ultimately related to him in love. In ignorance, you don't even think about these things at all. Who am I? Who are you? What's going on? All you know is your work. You know, I go to the factory, I do my work, I come home, drink some beer, watch TV, have sex, go to sleep. And you don't even think about what's the nature of things. And your knowledge is very meager. Your knowledge is not that much above the level of an animal, just how to maintain your body. So this is knowledge in the mode of goodness, that one sees that everyone is an equal soul. And we're aware of others' bodies, but we don't see them as the body, you follow? Okay, determination. Now, this is something that a lot of people misunderstand because passion is about intense endeavor to get a fruit. So many people equate determination with passion. And they think, if I don't have any passion in my life, I won't have any determination. But actually, in bhakti, one's determination is never interrupted, it's never personally motivated, and it's driven only by love. And determination in love is the only absolute unbreakable determination. Now, in goodness, it's almost unbreakable, and it's sustained with practice of yoga. It's determination that keeps one in balance. One is determined not to get out of balance. In passion, one's determined to get a particular result. I'm going to get this degree, I'm going to get this money, I'm going to get this house, I'm going to get this girl. And one will be very determined as long as the result looks achievable, and as soon as the result looks like it might not be achievable, then you lose your determination. In ignorance, determination is just dreaming. Oh, I'd like to be a doctor. I'd like to make a lot of money. Maybe I'll buy a lottery ticket. You know, you don't really do anything. And determination is a lot of lamentation. Oh, why didn't I do that when I was young? Oh, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? Happiness in bhakti is unlimited. Because the happiness in bhakti is because of connection with the unlimited Krishna. Although we are finite beings, as soon as we're connected with the infinite, we also enjoy infinitely. In goodness, it looks like poison at the beginning and nectar at the end. Why does it look like poison at the beginning? Because it involves not making some big endeavor to have big things in the world or just being lazy all the time. It involves some control of the mind and the senses. But it becomes nectar at the end because one experiences a happiness beyond the senses and beyond the mind. It awakens one to one's real position. In passion, one's happiness comes from basically the bodily senses. If I touch something soft, I see something beautiful, I hear something nice, I smell something nice, I taste something nice. And that's nectar in the beginning, but poison at the end. So there's some enjoyment when you have a contact between your body and the sense object, but it leads to distress and disappointment and boredom and so forth. And ignorance, the kind of happiness in ignorance is things like from sleep, laziness, illusion, and intoxication. And there's really no happiness there at all. There's some sort of a happiness that I'm a really bad person, I do really bad things, and get away from it. Or, you know, some kind of delusion of intoxication. But there's nothing in ignorance that you could call joy at all. At least in passion, there's a little bit of sensual happiness. But in ignorance, there's not even really that, because your sensual happiness is detrimental to your body. You understand? You're eating junk food, you're poisoning your body, you have unhealthy relationships, and so there's not really any happiness at all. So in goodness, it's an inner mental peace. Although in order to get that requires some restraint and austerity. So for example, if you regularly do some kind of meditation, you'll find that meditation gives you a happiness and goodness, gives you a happiness beyond the senses and the mind. But you have to take the trouble to do it. You understand? Happiness and ignorance, you just pop a pill and pretend that you're happy. You know, you smoke something, drink something. You know. It's cheap, apparently. Happiness and goodness, you have to say, okay, I'm going to take the time and I'm going to meditate and I'm going to control my mind. But then you experience this amazing happiness and peace. So happiness and passion really is poison, because it increases our material desires. It forces us back into rebirth. It requires no restraint and brings some immediate sensation and pleasure. And in ignorance, you mostly think about unattainable happiness. Maybe I'll be rich, maybe I'll be famous. And whenever we have deliberate self-forgetfulness through intoxication, or someone wishes they were dead, suicidal thoughts, oversleeping. So there's not even any kind of mental happiness in this mode. So when one achieves goodness, then one becomes peaceful, self-controlled, austere, pure, tolerant, honest, knowledgeable, wise, and religious. By religious here, we don't just mean a sort of sectarian religion, but we really mean Dharma. So how do we come to the mode of goodness? So good association with saintly persons, and to become absorbed with affection in the Lord's form, name, in the scriptures, and the holy places. Following the process of bhakti and making choices according to spiritual teachers and according to scripture will bring us very quickly to the mode of goodness. There are certainly other processes that will bring us to the mode of goodness by acting piously, but for the sake of liberation, by cultivating philosophical knowledge, by engaging in meditation. Those will also bring us to the mode of goodness. We would suggest, at least we here as practitioners of bhakti yoga, that coming to the mode of goodness through bhakti is much easier and more natural for most people than doing it in those other ways. So thank you very much. We have some time if there's any questions or discussion. Yes?
It's quite clear that goodness is meant to be something that you strive for all the time. But let's say you're in the mode of passion. Should you maybe try to go straight for bhakti, or try to, even while you're still in the mode of passion, try to focus on God rather than focus on being peaceful? Will it manifest?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So if we want to go ultimately to bhakti, should we try to move up through the modes or go right to bhakti? And our suggestion is go right to bhakti, because bhakti will automatically bring you to the mode of goodness. If a person is not interested in bhakti, then we would suggest just go to the mode of goodness. So there's a movement now in the world for the mode of goodness. The movement towards vegetarianism and yoga and meditation and environmentalism is very much a mode of goodness mood. So for people who aren't interested in bhakti, and some of those people aren't interested in bhakti, if you said, you know, are you interested in love for a personal God? They'd say, no way, I want nothing to do with it. So for such people, the mode of goodness is very favorable. But if you go directly to bhakti, goodness will definitely be achieved. And it's interesting, I'm in the process right now, it's not ready yet. I'm in the process of researching this. How it is that the meditation we do in bhakti, in kirtan, and in japa, etc., automatically brings about the results of the mode of goodness. And I became particularly interested in this because a friend of mine, who's a professor of mathematics, recommended that I read a book about Buddhist meditation. And in reading this, actually ended up reading two books by the author, in reading these books about Buddhist meditation, I realized that everything he was describing that was achieved by Buddhist meditation, I had achieved through bhakti. And I realized that everything he was describing was the mode of goodness. Because he wasn't interested in bhakti for a personal god. And he was just describing all these qualities and abilities that happened in the mode of goodness. And I thought, oh yeah. And so I started doing a lot of research into this. What are the different types of meditation? And what are the different ways of coming to the mode of goodness? And how does bhakti cover all of those? I should offer a caveat that one has to take up bhakti properly, or it won't be efficacious very quickly. If you take up bhakti as a set of external behaviors, the effect will be very, very slow and delayed. If you take up bhakti as it's supposed to be, a very deep meditative process of connection between the soul and Krishna, then you will very, very quickly achieve all the effects of the mode of goodness, even if you start off in the mode of ignorance, or to speak, if you start off in the mode of passion. And I was thinking about this, you know, with the kirtan we had here. You know, we have a personal meditation that we chant the Hare Krishna mantra and other mantras quietly just for ourselves to go into deep meditation on Krishna. But what we do in kirtan is also a kind of meditation. We should be meditating on the sound, and we should be meditating on the person of the sound, the person Krishna. And in many ways, that's easier to do in a group with music than to sit and just do alone by yourself without music. That if these things are made, is that we're then brought up by the energy of the group, isn't it? And music naturally, this not all music obviously, but this music naturally puts us in this mode of goodness where focusing is very easy. So that would be my suggestion. Is that all right? Anybody else? That was excellent. Thank you for asking. Yes.
Living in the world, if we have to execute different duties, you have to be in different modes. Not every job or occupation, to be able to do it successfully, one needs to be perhaps for certain jobs in the world of passion. Say from the Bhagavad Gita as an example, if one is as the nature of a Vaishya or a Kshatriya or a Shudra, then can one, in what sense does one come to the mode of goodness? And does this negatively influence one's ability to execute your duties?
This is a very nice group of people. It seems that there's a progression. So our duties, according to the Bhagavad Gita, what we do for our livelihood, should be according to the modes that we're in. Because each combination of the modes is going to make certain occupations easy and joyful for us, and certain occupations not very easy or joyful for us. So the way that Krishna has designed this universe is that the way we maintain ourselves should also be something that makes us happy, which everybody would like to do. Everybody would like to have their means of livelihood be something where they're finding personal fulfillment and personal joy. But that's very much connected to your modes of nature, because what you consider happiness depends on exactly how the modes combine in your body and mind. Does that make sense? So your occupation should be kind of a match between how the modes are in your body and mind and that occupation. So if we had, which we don't, but if we had a society in general where people's occupations were all according to their nature. I mean, there's an effort for that. People try to do that. So you start off with that, and you start off with you love your work because it resonates with your own energies. The energies of the work and your energies resonate together, and therefore you do that work. Now let's say while you're doing that work, you're not only doing it for your own satisfaction, but you're also doing it for the good of the whole. This is what we call Varnashram Dharma, which is what you're talking about, Brahma, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. The purpose of using those designations, and if some of you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm sorry, I'm going to try to make this as simple as I can. That the Bhagavad Gita takes all the, whatever, hundreds of thousands of occupations and puts them into four categories. For the purpose of saying that if your occupation fits in this category, this is how you can use it not only for self-satisfaction, but also for the good of society in general and people in general. And beyond that, for the good of the universe. You know, a lot of people now talk about the universe. What does the universe want? How do you relate with the universe? Yes, you hear a lot of people talking like that. Do you know that in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 11th chapter, and in the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in the second canto, there's many descriptions as the universe as a body of God. And the idea of having these occupations that resonate with our nature is also, don't just do them for yourself, but do them for the sake of harmony in the universe. If any of you have studied sociology, this is called functionalism. That we have an occupation that makes us happy, and it's each occupation has a particular role in the social body and in the universal body. Now, if you take it that extra step, which makes it Varna Dharma instead of just Varna, you're then offering your occupation for the benefit of the universal body, which is a form of Krishna. You with me? You following that step? Okay? That's kind of the next step. I'm doing it not just because it resonates with me, but also, what do they say? Where your greatest joy meets the world's greatest need. You've heard that before? Yes? So you're doing an occupation that fulfills you and also allows you to be part of the whole. Well, something interesting happens as soon as we start doing our livelihood, not only for ourselves, but also for the benefit of others. And I'm going to say something really radical here. You know, in our modern society, people get a job and a house but don't get married. Do you know one of the purposes of marriage is to decrease selfishness? That you're not just earning money for yourself? You know, this concept that I should have a job that's just for my own satisfaction is a very, very modern thing. It may be only like 15, 20 years that people have felt like this. At least people think I should have a job for the benefit of my family. At least that's something. But when you go beyond just the benefit of my family for the benefit of the universe, then something happens. That's called karma yoga. Now, if you also do bhakti, then you're not just doing it for the benefit of the universal body of God, you're doing it for the smile and the pleasure of the personal God, Krishna. Then what happens is, you start coming to the detachment of the mode of goodness. You start experiencing a pleasure within that is not conditional on what you're doing. You no longer need a certain sensory environment, nor a certain egotistical sense of self by the praise of others or self-praise in order to experience happiness. You no longer need to accomplish anything in order to experience happiness. You don't have to be a really good teacher or a really good engineer or a really good actor or a really good anything. You don't have to be a good, you know, son or daughter. You don't need to be a good husband or wife or a good anything to feel happiness. You just feel happiness because you feel happiness. In that state, one may say, oh, I don't really have a need to do my occupation anymore to feel fulfilled. You following this? First step, I do my occupation because it resonates with my own energies. Next step, I do my occupation because it fulfills me and I also do it for the greater good. At least for my family, better that for the universal body, better that for a personal God. If I'm working for a personal God or the universal body, I will start to come to sattva guna, which gives me a pleasure independent of what I'm doing. I no longer require to do anything for my happiness except just be who I am, because I am happiness. At that point, Krishna says, you no longer have a need to do your work or a need to give it up. It simply doesn't matter to you whether you do work or not. And you see that Krishna himself, or the universe, is maintaining you anyway. At that point then, you may continue to do your work in service to Krishna. And why would you continue to do that same work? Why would you do that work that resonated with your modes when you're no longer being affected by the modes? Because it still continues to be the work that you're really good at. So you're probably going to keep doing that. But for Krishna, with detachment, you could leave it at any time. It's, the work itself is no longer your source of happiness. It's your connection with Krishna that's your source of happiness. Could you, at that stage of detachment, give up that work or change that work? Yes, you could. But you don't have any particular reason to do that any more than you have any particular reason to go on doing the work. When people reach that point of equilibrium, they sometimes become a little confused because their former motivators are gone. Their motivators for glory, or their motivators for their self-ego, or their motivators even for money, or their motivators to accomplish something in the world are gone. They're happy without those things. And they, many times people get to that point and say, well, why should I do this anymore? But if you go to bhakti, if I'm going to work for Krishna, I might as well do for Krishna the thing that I spent 10 years becoming expert at. You follow? Or 20 years or 30 years becoming expert at. Does that make sense? Why not? Well, am I going to start doing something for Krishna that I have no expertise in? I mean, it could. So would one change one occupation at that point? You could. You could. But you wouldn't have to. Because you're no longer doing that occupation for some material resonation. You're doing it for a spiritual resonation. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
And I'm so happy you asked that. Yes?
I come from a background where it's very easy to say words. You know, as you say, I can do my work for Krishna, my I love God, things like that.
Yes, yes.
So what's the difference to really have something behind the words? You know, not to just... Because it's very easy to say it, and then you don't actually even know what it means.
Yes, well, but that's a good start. I know when I joined the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, one of the first things I was socialized into is what I call humble talk. And so if you hang around Hare Krishna devotees for any length of time, you'll notice that one of the things they regularly do is this thing that I call humble talk. Oh, I'm not really very good at anything. Oh, I'm so fallen. You know, after I became socialized into it, at one point I started questioning what in the world I was doing. And was it really spiritual? Was it really meaningful? And was that, was really humility, self-putting downness? And then at one point I got as part of my doctorate, I did an internship where I worked out in the world. And I saw that people there didn't even do humble talk at all. And then I started appreciating the devotees' false, superficial, stupid, humble talk. I thought, well, at least they're trying. At least they have some idea. You follow? I thought, it does have some value. Now, if it stays on that level, it doesn't have any value. Ultimately. But it's a value to start with. And frankly... for most people who are beginners in bhakti, if you really saw how bad it was, you'd get so discouraged that you would just stop. So it's awfully good in the beginning to say, yes, I love God and I'm spiritual. And I don't know if I should tell any of you this. Nobody told me this, okay? And if anybody had told me this, I don't know if I would have taken up bhakti. But I kind of wish they had told me this. So I'm telling you it, and I hope it doesn't discourage you. One of the things you see in bhakti is how much of a faker and a pretender you are, and how materially attached you are, and all this stuff. You end up seeing all that stuff. I'm really looking to how bhakti relates in general to various traditions, and I have an email sitting in my inbox from a teacher of Vipassana meditation. And he was talking about how the meditation he teaches shows you the naked truth of everything, even something that's not so palatable. So, you know, when you really see the truth, you're going to see both that you're eternally a part of God, you're wonderful, you're amazing, you're just full of light and love and peace and charity and all good qualities, all the qualities of God. But you'll also see that you're intentionally doing really stupid, nasty, mean, cruel, selfish things. And if you saw that on day one, it would be so discouraging that you would never do anything. So it's really helpful on day one to say, I am so spiritual. It is. One of our great saintly teachers, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, calls this false confidence. I'm so spiritual, I'm probably going to be enlightened next week. You know? But it's useful in the beginning for most people. Unfortunately. It is. If your practice is deep and genuine, you will start realizing the truth yourself. Which is a gazillion, million, billion times more satisfying than superficial talk. But it has some value in the beginning. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talked about the little kid who goes to school, you know, their first few days of school. I'm learning how to read! You know, what can they read? Cat. Right? But it has some value. Or the little child when they first stand up without holding on to anything and they're all excited, right? They're not really walking, but that enthusiasm is good in the beginning. But please, get the experience. Don't stay on the platform of just talk and belief and dogma and convince yourself that on the platform of talk and belief and dogma that you're a religious or spiritual person. Yeah, it's a useful crutch and scaffolding in the beginning. It is. It really is. But that, you know, you don't want to just use a crutch, you want to dance. You want it to be real. So take the plunge and make it real. Be willing to face truth. Don't be afraid of truth. Even though the light of truth will also reveal our own foolishness. It will, and it will sting. But it won't sting forever. It will sting. It will. Yeah. It will. I don't see any way to avoid that. There has to be a recognition that I have willfully avoided truth. there has to be some recognition of that to fully come to truth. And most people who stay on the words, it's because they're afraid of that. You follow? They're afraid of facing that part that has to also be dealt with. It's like, I'm this wonderful, glorious being who just swam in the sewer. What did I do? And both of those things need to be seen, side by side. So please, have courage. Have fearlessness. Don't be afraid of truth. It's the only way to get off the superficial platform. Yes?
I was just thinking, you said we should speak the truth. And
yes.
Things that benefit other people.
Correct.
But the truth for me might not be the truth for someone else.
Oh, okay.
So how does that affect them?
Okay. Yes, what we understand of truth depends in our modes. So someone in the mode of ignorance, what they perceive as truth is all backwards. They perceive false things to be truth and true things to be false. They're basically blind to truth. You know, to the mode of ignorance, what's truth is that person's my enemy and should be killed because they have a different shaped nose than mine. You know, that's the truth in the mode of ignorance. Everyone else is to blame for all of my problems and I'm perfect, powerful, and happy. And that's their truth. And in the mode of passion, you know, a person's truth is, again, I'm great and powerful and I'm going to be the savior of the world and I'm the doer of my activities, and it just, you know, through hard work and determination, you're going to conquer the world. And a person in the mode of goodness, their truth is, we're all connected, we're all spiritual, there's an inner peace and there's an inner harmony. And someone in bhakti, their truth is, there's a personal God who loves all of us and we're connected with them. So it's a fact that unless one's in a higher mode, one's truth that one will be able to speak is not going to be truth. It's also a fact that who you're speaking to, depending on the mode that they're in, may be more or less receptive to your truth. So the first thing is to make sure you're speaking truth. Now, how do you make sure you're speaking truth? Well, one of the five things is to study the sacred literatures. But of course, that may just remove the problem a step, because suppose you study the sacred literatures in the mode of ignorance. Do people do that? Yes, all the time. Yes, correct? People study their scriptures from the platform of ignorance to justify their violent, cruel behavior. Is that correct? Right? Have most religions in the world done this? I find it very interesting that with all the talk of radical Islamic terrorists, we forget that there were radical Christian terrorists. And it wasn't all that long ago in human history. Yes? Am I correct, historically speaking? Huh? So, this speaking truth, there's an assumption there that you yourself can see truth. And in order to see truth, one has to oneself come to the mode of goodness, at least, so that the window is clear. How do you know that what you're seeing is truth? You're filled with happiness. You're filled with equilibrium, with detachment. You see everyone equally. You're peaceful. You're not dependent on the ordinary course of events for your happiness. You're not dependent on sensory experiences for your happiness. You're not dependent on praise, either self-praise or others' praise for your happiness. You have this very authentic experience. You have an experience of things being real. Otherwise, yeah, what we may think is truth may be not truth at all. Okay, should I end here or should I take any more questions? You're in charge, up to you.
Okay, we take one more question.
Okay, anybody else have another question? Yes?
Is it possible to be in the mode of passion but your motive is either goodness or...
Could you be mixed? Yes, you can be mixed.
No, but not mixed. Your motive for doing that endeavor is in the mode of goodness.
Then you're in the mode of goodness.
Basically,
think of the mode of passion, you do the wrong things for the wrong reason. The mode of ignorance, you do the wrong things for the wrong reason. The mode of passion, you do the right things for the wrong reason. The mode of goodness, you do the right things for the right reason. And in bhakti, you're doing things for the ultimate reason of love. So the mode of ignorance, what you do is wrong, and you're doing it out of selfishness. Mostly in the mode of ignorance, you want immediate gratification. You want immediate removal of suffering and you want immediate experience of sensory happiness. In the mode of passion, you're willing to have some effort and some endeavor, but you're still, your idea is your own personal happiness. Sensory happiness and, you know, mental glory. In the mode of goodness, you're doing things for your own sense of inner peace and balance, which is still ultimately selfish. It's not the selflessness of love of bhakti. But wanting to do things for your own inner sense of peace and balance is naturally going to involve being genuinely good to others. In the mode of passion, you don't particularly care about others, only in as much as it will help your own ego. So in the mode of passion, you know, you may want to feed millions of starving people, but also you can say, I'm a good person. Yes, I am. Can you give me a plaque? You fall? I don't really connect with the people. In the mode of goodness, I'm actually connecting with people. I want to help other people because helping other people makes, it's still me, whereas in bhakti it's not at all, but it still, it makes me feel connected. And I have some genuine care about you. Can activities in the mode of goodness and passion look very similar or almost identical? Yes. It's rare that activities in ignorance look like anything but ignorance. But the external behaviors in the mode of passion and goodness and bhakti can be very similar, almost indistinguishable. The main way you distinguish it is that the person in the mode of passion is generally much more interested in more, bigger. The mode of passion is more emphasis on quantity rather than quality. But otherwise, the external behaviors are very, very simple. Can be very, very simple. They can be. Is that okay? If you're really if you're all really interested in the subject, the book I would highly recommend is the Bhagavad Gita. And these are particularly discussed in the 14th, 17th, and 18th chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna.